The decisions are in. A blockbuster Supreme Court term ends with the court fractured along ideological lines. One of America's leading Supreme Court reporters joins us to discuss rulings on presidential immunity, abortion, the administrative state, guns, and more. What does the court decision on presidential immunity mean for the future of the American presidency? Is it true that the president is now above the law? A presidential scholar and historian shares his insights.
The National Eucharistic Pilgrimage comes to Chicago for the weekend. I'm Mark Irons with an update from the Marion Route.
Back on the trail with pilgrims as they slowly make their way across country to this month's National Eucharistic Congress. And the remarkable story of a Christian community in Texas whose parishioners adopt dozens of neglected and mistreated children. We talk to the lead actor of the new movie, Sound of Hope. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Hello, I'm Catherine Hadro. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth as we examine a United States Supreme Court term in which justices made monumental decisions that could reshape American society. A court divided along ideological lines, erased the power of federal agencies, supercharged the power of the presidency, and made major rulings on voting rights, guns, public corruption, and how cities may deal with homelessness. It was the last ruling, the one about presidential immunity, that caught most observers off guard.
I think it opens the doors for fascism, for dictatorship.
A small group of protesters stood outside the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday, reacting to the high court's decision to grant former President Donald Trump broad immunity from criminal prosecution. Along ideological lines, by a vote of 6-3, the six conservative justices ruled that presidents have immunity for official acts. But not all acts are official, and it's up to lower courts to determine which acts qualify. In writing the opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts said, like everyone else, the president is subject to prosecution in his unofficial capacity. But unlike anyone else, the president is a branch of government, and the Constitution vests in him sweeping powers and duties. This further delays a trial on federal election subversion charges pending against the former president. Justice Sonia Sotomayor slammed the majority opinion in her dissent. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. Former President Donald Trump took to his social media platform, Truth Social, to celebrate the ruling, calling it a big win for our Constitution and democracy. But President Joe Biden decried it.
No one is above the law, not even the President of the United States.
This decision was just one of a handful of blockbuster cases the Supreme Court ruled on this year. One of the biggest, Chevron deference, a decades-old doctrine that allows federal agencies to interpret laws they administer when the text is silent or ambiguous. In another ideological split in a 6-3 decision, the court reversed Chevron, which many say will have a rippling effect in courts across the country. The high court took on three cases that deal with guns. Justices unanimously ruled that a New York official violated the National Rifle Association's freedom of speech when she encouraged insurance groups to distance themselves from the gun advocacy group. The court also dismissed a ban on bump stocks, a device that can be attached to rifles that enable firing similar to a machine gun. But the court maintained a federal law that prohibits people with domestic violence restraining orders from possessing a firearm. Three cases concerned free speech on social media. In Murphy v. Missouri, the court sided with the Biden administration in a lawsuit that challenged the federal government's role in managing information on social media. And in NetChoice v. Moody, consolidated with NetChoice v. Paxton, the high court unanimously ruled to put social media laws in Texas and Florida on hold while their cases are once again argued in lower courts. The laws bar social media sites from banning or restricting political voices, which social media companies argued violated their First Amendment right to moderate content on their platforms. The high court also ruled on homelessness.
As a result of this decision, we are able to enforce the law and to clear the encampments off the street now.
Now there are way too many people on the streets. And there's going to be more because of this case.
Along ideological lines, the justices found that local bans on sleeping in public spaces do not constitute cruel and unusual punishment on homeless people who may have nowhere else to go. And in two cases, the high court punted the issue of abortion back to the lower courts. The justices ruled a group of pro-life doctors did not have legal standing to sue the FDA over its approval of the abortion pill mifepristone. In another limited ruling, the Supreme Court decided that Idaho is required to perform abortions under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, also known as EMTALA. Though initial disappointments for pro-life advocates, these cases continue in the lower courts and could ultimately find their way back to the Supreme Court in the future.
To discuss this momentous court term, we are joined by Supreme Court reporter Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS blog. Every opinion day, court watchers are glued to their screens on the SCOTUS blog website, ready for Amy to do a quick live announcement and legal explanation as the court announces each decision. Amy, welcome. And wow, what a monumental couple of weeks. You've covered the Supreme Court for more than 20 years. Now that all the decisions are in, how would you characterize this Supreme Court term with more than two-thirds of the rulings decided by a 6-3 vote? And even the conservative majority was divided with concurring opinions at a record rate.
This is a very conservative court. The court had several decisions on issues like presidential immunity, and in particular on the role of federal agencies that really moved the court to the right. Moved the law to the right. You know, there were some issues that they took up, like abortion, that they didn't actually reach a decision on the merits, but it was really a blockbuster term.
Let's talk about some of those specific cases. The decision giving presidents partial immunity against prosecution drew especially sharp words from both ideological sides of the ruling. This blistering dissent from Justice Sotomayor. Quote, it makes a mockery of the principle foundational to our Constitution and system of government that no man is above the law, orders the Navy's SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival, immune, organizes a military coup to hold on to power, immune, takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon, immune, 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 immune. And then a sharp rebuke from Chief Justice Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, quote, as for the dissents, they strike a tone of chilling doom that is wholly disproportionate to what the court actually does today. Conclude that immunity extends to official discussions between the president and his attorney general, and then remand to the lower courts. Amy, what are your thoughts about this ruling, its impact, and how it divided the court?
This was really some of the sharpest divisions that I think any of us have ever seen, particularly some of the language in the dissent. And you really see two fundamentally different views of why immunity is or is not needed. You know, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, talks about the need for immunity so that presidents can make decisions without worrying about liability after they leave office, and talking about the possibility that if former presidents could face criminal charges, that there would be this sort of tit for tat that would spiral on down the line, creating this vicious cycle. And then the dissenting justices saw the majority's ruling as a kind of existential threat to democracy, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor's opinion and an opinion by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said. You know, the Justice Sonia Sotomayor said essentially that the majority had created a king, and so they were concerned about a sort of the flip side of the coin about being able to hold former presidents liable when they do break the law.
Moving on along to another big case, the longstanding Chevron decision called on judges to defer to federal regulators when the words of a statute are not crystal clear. Now that Chevron is overruled, Amy, could this lead to a flood of lawsuits regarding federal agencies? And what about lawsuits challenging decisions made by the Food and Drug Administration?
So that is really something that I think has yet to be seen, but I think that is the prediction. And the Chevron decision is something that had been a target for conservative legal scholars and conservative lawyers for a long time. The Supreme Court had had several requests in recent years to overturn this Chevron doctrine, which dates back to 1984. And they had rejected earlier requests, but they agreed to take up a pair of cases asking them to overrule the Chevron doctrine this year. But Justice Elena Kagan wrote for the three-justice dissent in this case, and she described it as a real shock to the legal system because the Chevron doctrine, she said, was so much a part of how the U.S. legal system worked. Chief Justice John Roberts, who wrote for the majority, seemed less concerned about the impact. He said, you know, we haven't cited the decision since 2016. But I do think it's likely to lead to new lawsuits challenging agency actions. And in particular, there was another decision by the Supreme Court that sort of flew under the radar about when you can bring a lawsuit to challenge agency action. The Supreme Court, in a case called Corner Post, on Monday held that the statute of limitations to challenge an agency action, which is 6 years, doesn't start to run until you, as a plaintiff, are actually injured by the agency action. So the Supreme Court expanded the window in which these lawsuits challenging agency action can be brought as well. Mm.
Amy, abortion was on the docket this term, including a case on the abortion pill mifepristone. The justices ruled the pro-life plaintiffs did not have standing to sue the FDA over its approval of mifepristone. And in another abortion case involving the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, the justices allowed an Idaho federal court order to continue blocking a pro-life law passed by the Idaho legislature. But the justices in that case did not say why they dismissed the case, much less offer a judicial opinion on the merits of it. Can you explain, Amy, why the justices in both of these cases, the mifepristone and the Idaho one, are declining to weigh in specifically on abortion?
It's really a great question. Yeah, we don't know exactly what the answer is. The doctrine of standing, the idea that you have to have a legal right to sue, sounds like a procedural technical one, but it is a basic part of being able to bring a lawsuit. In that case, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that those challengers don't have standing. They sent the case back to the lower court. There are states that are seeking to challenge the FDA's approval of mifepristone and the increased access to mifepristone as well. So the fact that the Supreme Court ruled that the particular set of challengers before it don't have standing doesn't necessarily mean that the challenge could not go on in some other iteration. As far as the EMTALA challenge, the challenge to the Idaho abortion ban and whether or not Idaho's strict ban on abortion conflicts with a federal law that requires hospitals that receive Medicare funding to provide abortions, to provide emergency treatment, which the Biden administration says includes abortions, whether that conflict. So the justices as a whole didn't explain exactly why they weren't ruling on the issue. There were a couple of different opinions by various justices. Three of the court's conservative justices, in an opinion written by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, suggested that the case that the Supreme Court had before it after the oral argument wasn't really the case that they thought that they were getting, that the facts and the arguments had changed. And so that those three justices at the very least thought it would be better to let the case proceed in the lower court. Mm. That case, too, could come back to them. There's also a similar case out of Texas. And of course, there's also the possibility this is a case, this is not a constitutional case. This is a case brought by the Biden administration in a second Trump administration. It seems very likely that a Trump administration Department of Justice would not necessarily pursue such a case.
Amy, we'll continue to monitor that. Absolutely. Real quick, we have two more questions I'd love to get your take on. We had a Supreme Court ruling on homelessness. What exactly was decided and how will the ruling on homelessness directly impact people who are unhoused in the U.S.?
Yeah, so this was a challenge to a set of ordinances in an Oregon city that prohibit public camping, and it would preclude people who are unhoused from using a blanket or pillows or cardboard boxes to sleep in public. And so a group of people who are unhoused in the city, Grants Pass, Oregon, went to court arguing that it violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment because it effectively punished them for being homeless. And the Supreme Court rejected their challenge to the constitutionality of these ordinances. Mm-hmm. It said that, you know, that this obviously homelessness is a real problem, but that these ordinances don't violate the Constitution. This is not the kind of decision that federal judges should be making, that these are policy problems for the American people and the democratic process to solve. And so, you know, for people who are unhoused, you know, it means that cities can have these kinds of ordinances. Cities have argued that not being able to enforce these kinds of ordinances actually makes their job of providing housing more difficult. And there's some dispute about that. But, you know, obviously it's a very sad, very sad, very difficult and very complicated situation.
In our final moments, Amy, I need to ask you this question. The flurry of controversial opinions and sharp dissents this term came amid historically low approval ratings for this court. And there was a critical spotlight on a few justices facing questions about ethical propriety and calls for recusal. As someone who closely watches the court, are you able to discern what is happening internally among the justices? Is the institution fractured?
You know, it's hard to tell. You know, we see the justices when they are on the bench and then when they are issuing opinions. So it's really hard to tell. Sometimes you can read a little bit into their public appearances. And so Justice Sonia Sotomayor, in a public appearance earlier this year, talked about how she would sometimes go back to her chambers and cry. But mostly what we see is we read their opinions, and then the people who are lucky enough to be in the courtroom and hear the announcement of the opinions are the ones who really get a sense of what's going on. And certainly the dissents that we've seen are some of the sharpest that I've seen in all of the time that I've been covering the Supreme Court. And, you know, we haven't had any sense that anyone's going to retire anytime soon. The end of the term is a traditional time for justices to announce their retirements. And so it seems like that, you know, it's going to be this nine group of justices together for the foreseeable future.
Amy Howe, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
When we return, we continue our analysis of this Supreme Court term's decision on presidential immunity with a leading presidential historian and digging into financial mismanagement at the Vatican. We talked to the former Vatican Auditor General.
When the Pope heard these concerns of yours and he saw the evidence that you were putting in front of him, what was his reaction?
He was overwhelmed. He didn't believe that this could happen, but I had all the detail, and he examined it and understood.
Why his proposed audit of the Vatican's financial books was shut down. That interview coming up.
What's happening with Possum Trot could mean a huge change for the system.
We want the ones that nobody else wants.
And later, unwanted foster children given new hope by Christian hearts who accept them as family. We talk to the movie actor who plays the role of the real-life Texas pastor who encouraged dozens of adoptions. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back. Welcome back to EWTN News in Depth as we continue our discussion about the Supreme Court's blockbuster decision in the Trump versus the United States presidential immunity case. Legal ramifications of the court's far-reaching ruling are already being felt. The former president was to be sentenced next week in the New York hush money case. He was found guilty in May of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. But on Tuesday, trial judge Juan Mershon pushed back sentencing until September to allow attorneys for both sides to make legal filings reflective of the high court's decision. It is not clear whether or not the Supreme Court case will affect this state court prosecution on what was presumably private conduct prior to Mr. Trump becoming president. To talk more about the implications of the Supreme Court presidential immunity decision and what that means for the future, we are joined by Dr. David Barrett, presidential historian and professor of political science at Villanova University outside of Philadelphia. Professor, welcome to the show. From your perspective, how significant is this Supreme Court ruling? We know President Biden certainly finds it disturbing. He made this announcement from the White House hours after the ruling. Let's take a listen.
Today's decision almost certainly means that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. This is a fundamentally new principle, and it's a dangerous precedent, because the power of the office will no longer be constrained by the law, even including the Supreme Court of the United States. The only limits will be self-imposed by the president alone.
Professor, what is your opinion? Do you agree or disagree with his view?
Well, I'm doing more a legal, more a political than a legal analysis. You know, I've studied presidents. They don't actually spend a lot of time reading Supreme Court decisions, reading the Constitution, that sort of thing. They are very much politicians. And it's interesting that President Biden used that kind of language, because one wonders if future presidents, one wonders if, say, former President Trump should become President Trump, if he would say, well, this is what Joe Biden said, you know, unlimited power and all that. I think it's going to depend in the future very much on the particular president and what he wants to do with the office. Presidents do tend to have lawyers, not always, but usually, who tell them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And the trend across many decades is the lawyers have said to presidents, yes, you can do this. You have the executive power. You're the commander in chief. So this might open up, I think, somewhat the possibility of presidents using power in a dangerous way. I don't see it as being, I don't think presidents will act as dangerously as President Biden has said. But it is a possibility. It depends on who's president. Mm.
The question at the heart of this case, is a president immune from criminal prosecution for official acts while in office, was the question. Has that ever arisen in U.S. presidential history before?
You know, I was thinking back about presidents and, you know, and there have been presidents who got into legal, severe political troubles, like Clinton and Nixon, especially come to mind. But, you know, mostly this is not something that's really much arisen of presidents, I think, spending time doing the court. You know, when I looked at the opinion, the majority seemed quite concerned with presidents being too hesitant or too passive in fear of being criminally prosecuted. And I just don't see that arising much to the extent we can read the minds of past presidents. And one has to say, with someone like Nixon, maybe if he had thought about that, he might have restrained himself a bit. So I don't think it's arisen very much. I don't see it in presidential history.
Well, to that point, just a quick follow-up. Do you think this would have applied to President Nixon in his case?
It's interesting you asked me that question, because, and you know, my sort of specialty as a political scientist and presidential historian is the sort of post-World War II presidencies, especially through Nixon. And I was thinking to myself, now what, you know, there's that famous smoking gun conversation that President Nixon had with a couple of high-level White House staffer type people. You know, what if he had called in the attorney general and said, you know, I'm thinking about directing that this be done. And I'm directing, because the idea, the smoking gun conversation, was Nixon telling these staffers to tell the CIA, to tell the FBI to back off from its rather aggressive investigation. So what if Nixon, under the circumstances now in the aftermath of this latest ruling, would Nixon have gotten off? We don't know. The other thing is that what was happening with Nixon was that he was going to be impeached and then almost certainly convicted. So there's the legal and then there's the political.
Right, absolutely. Professor, in her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor claims this ruling means that a president would be immune from ordering the Navy's SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival. Again, I know you're a political scientist, but is that your interpretation of this?
Well, I have to say, overall, so I read her dissent. And I think in most respects, it's really quite impressive. And it occurred to me when I was reading, you know, the court issues this thing they call a syllabus, which is 10 or 11 page summary of the decision and then her dissent. And they're pretty readable. And I thought she was pretty impressive. But that struck me as far-fetched.
I am curious on your thoughts on this. What do you think will be the greatest consequence of this ruling on the presidency in the future?
Well, let me start with a Trump presidency. Should Donald Trump win election to another term as president? You know, he did say this thing a couple of times. Well, maybe on the first day, I'll I'll be, or I'll act like a dictator. So I do wonder what consequences this decision will have on him and in his mind, keeping in mind, again, presidents don't, they don't read these, they don't read Supreme Court decisions and all these things. They're political figures. So I wonder if he is elected, how he was going to understand what this decision means. Because in fairness to the majority, they do say no one is above the law. Presidents are not above the law. So they point out parts in which, you know, the claims of the Trump lawyers were wrong. But how will Donald Trump read this decision? I think that's a very important question.
Well, we so appreciate your historical context on all of this. Professor David Barrett, thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I think it's important that we come together around what we believe and we come together around Jesus Christ.
Next, EWTN News in Depth is in Chicago with Perpetual Pilgrims on the North Marian route of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Their deepening faith journey and belief in the real presence of Christ and the Eucharist when we come back. We are in the final countdown of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage as faithful followers of Christ make their way from four corners of the United States to this month's National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Over the past 2 months, we have shown you their progress on these faith journeys. Today, we are on the North Marian route in Chicago. Mark Irons has our report.
Cultural and ethnic diversity has deep roots in Chicago.
The beauty of the different cultures is celebrated in the church.
Catholic immigrants settled here in large waves starting in the 19th century.
My grandparents came from Poland over 100 years ago. It was around 1907.
People came to the city looking for a home, which is something Sarah Cahill gave up to join the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage.
Giving up housing was really hard for me, not to have a plan for where to live when I came back, and still not having a plan.
She's on the Midwestern leg of the pilgrimage. It started in northern Minnesota back in May and just passed through Chicago. To spend 2 months on pilgrimage, Sarah had to give up housing and her job in Philadelphia.
And that was something at the beginning that I wrestled with, of like, why? I'm angry, I'm annoyed about this.
But she says there's an invaluable lesson.
Learning how to have a home with Jesus.
The pilgrimage stopped for a few days in Chicago as events were planned throughout the Archdiocese. We witnessed different scenes of faith and devotion all united together by the Eucharist.
We truly believe that that is Jesus Christ, his flesh and blood, you know, soul and divinity.
We are adoring our Lord Jesus Christ as our Savior.
There was Mass and adoration at a historic African-American parish.
That it is truly the body and blood of Christ. And to receive that gives me joy.
And a Eucharistic procession at a Polish mission church.
And that is a symbol, but I mean, he said at the Last Supper, this is my body, this is my blood.
There was also a night of prayer, food, and fellowship for young adults.
And the Eucharist is the source and summit of my life, and he has transformed my life in so many miraculous ways.
There are many young adults your age that don't believe in Jesus, don't believe in his presence in the Eucharist. What do you say to those people?
I think it's something very hard to grasp, but it's something you have to give it a try. I think many of us young adults are seeking for something. God is there waiting for us in the tabernacle. He's just waiting.
And in the presence of the Eucharistic Lord, praise and worship music, along with personal testimonies hosted by the Asian Catholic Initiative. Eastern Catholic churches were also represented. There was a Eucharistic procession with the Syro-Malabar community. And we spoke with Jerome, a Maronite Catholic, who said all these expressions of the one Catholic faith are connected by the Eucharist.
It's the purpose of our life. It is like a focus point where you probably come from different liturgical traditions, but it's one thing that's common within all those liturgical traditions.
Deacon James Norman spoke to us about the gift of this blessed sacrament.
And that it's here and available to each of us each and every day. I think it's important that we come together around what we believe. For those who are not sure, have been away from the church, should take this opportunity to come back and be in community and be in the presence of Jesus Christ.
Others told us the public displays of faith on this pilgrimage provide an opportunity to welcome all people, including non-Catholics, to church.
Even though they are not Catholics, they are all welcome.
For Catholic Mary Lato, her love for Christ and the Eucharist grew when she returned to the sacrament of confession.
It took a lot of courage. I was feeling so much shame. I was terrified to go to confession, horrified. I was like, this is so scary. I can't talk about these things. The priest never hears this. Like, yes, he does. So I brought Jesus everything in my first confession. And after, I left the most free I've ever felt. And the Eucharist was so different after that moment. I was like, now I know why we need to receive Jesus in a state of grace.
In addition to all the Eucharistic devotions, the Archdiocese also hosted service projects, including organizing care packages for pregnant women in need and homeless individuals.
If we didn't go out with Jesus and actually love other people, our communion with him wouldn't be bearing fruit, and it wouldn't be a true communion. And so we have to, actually. It's an imperative, it's a demand of the gospel to love and serve.
Sister Alicia Torres, who serves on the executive team of the National Eucharistic Revival, told us some of the poorest neighborhoods in the country and some of the most affluent suburbs can be found in Chicago.
Our call to invite those who have so much to share with those who have so little is also very, very visible here.
The weekend capped off with a Sunday Mass celebrated by the Archbishop of Chicago, Cardinal Blaise Supich, who preached about the healing power of the Eucharist. He then led a procession around Holy Name Cathedral in the city. For Sarah Cahill, she says walking along the Marian route of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage reminds her of what true home really is. Not material, but spiritual.
Gift of, like, this is actually a homecoming. And this is actually, I can learn to have a home in eternity in the Blessed Sacrament. And it's hard. I want a material home. But that's been something I think just learning how to rest in that.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Beautiful. Now let's take a look at what happened this week on the other pilgrimage routes. From the southern Juan Diego route, the Dominican Sisters of St. Cecilia in Nashville welcomed the pilgrims at their mother house, hosting an outdoor mass where an estimated 1,000 people attended. Afterwards, pilgrims processed, taking a tour of the oldest churches in Nashville, one dating back to 1847. Bishop Mark Spalding led the procession on Sunday, while the Dominican Sisters led the procession in song. Along the eastern Seton route, pilgrims made their way through the Diocese of Columbus, Ohio, making stops at a prison and a senior healthcare facility. Bishop Earl Fernandez offered Mass and adoration for those incarcerated, while Seton chaplain Father Roger Landry offered Mass and benediction for the aged and infirm. Father Landry also celebrated the 25th anniversary of his priestly vocation, celebrating Mass at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Parish, the namesake of his route. In Kansas, along the western Sarah route, more than 1,000 pilgrims processed through Atchison, across the Amelia Earhart Bridge, and through Benedictine College's campus. Benedictine College held Vespers with the monks there and evening adoration in the college gymnasium. Earlier that day, the servants of the Pierced Hearts of Jesus and Mary led a Eucharistic cenacle or mass, followed by praise and worship, adoration and healing for the community. The National Eucharistic Congress is less than 2 weeks away. To be a part of it all, register at EWTN.com/Eucharist to receive a discounted pass. If you cannot be there in person, EWTN has you covered. I will be co-hosting coverage Wednesday through Sunday, July 17th through the 21st, with Father Aquinas Gilbo, University Chaplain at the Catholic University of America, and Pete Burak, Vice President of Renewal Ministries. In-depth reporters Mark Irons and Roselle Regis will be there too. Headlines are next in the Week in Review, including news of the church's first millennial saint and an interview with the former Vatican Auditor General, what he found when he attempted to audit the mysterious thicket of Vatican financial accounts. We'll be right back. A deadly stampede at a religious event in India tops the Week in Review. The panic left more than 120 people dead and dozens injured, many of them women and children. Relatives mourned the loss of loved ones at the event on Tuesday. Though event planners only had a permit for 5,000 attendees, more than 15,000 actually showed up to hear the preaching of a Hindu guru. The stampede erupted in the makeshift tent after some devotees tried to rush the stage and touch the guru. Authorities are still investigating the cause of the stampede, but suggest heat and suffocation in the tent could have been factors. Temperatures in the area approached 100 degrees Fahrenheit with very high humidity. As temperatures climb to dangerous levels in many parts of the United States, President Joe Biden proposed a new rule this week to address excessive heat in the workplace. The proposal would require employers to create heat safety plans, as well as provide rest areas and water when the heat index reaches 80 degrees or higher. If finalized, the measure would protect more than 36 million workers from injuries related to heat exposure. When announcing the measure, Biden criticized his Republican colleagues who do not believe in climate change. More than 200 candidates bowed out of France's parliamentary elections this week in an attempt to curb the far right's reach. The strategy comes just days after the Conservative Party made significant gains in the first round of national elections. President Emmanuel Macron called the election after far-right parties earned a record number of seats at the European Union last month. But his gamble to keep the far-right out of France's government is not paying off, as far-right candidates earned more than a third of votes last Sunday. By pulling out of the race, these left- and center-leaning candidates can shift votes to a single candidate, strengthening their chances of winning against the far-right. The second round of the French election will take place this Sunday. And in an update from France to a report we brought you last week, the Bishop of Lourdes says disgraced Father Marco Rupnik's mosaics will stay at the Shrine Basilica for now, but believe they should be taken down. Nearly 30 women, including many religious, have accused Rupnik of psychological and sexual abuse. Rupnik's mosaics are prominent at Catholic churches around the globe. Bishop Jean-Marc Mika believes the issue of the artwork is too polarizing and wants to avoid, quote, tearing the church apart. He made his decision after holding reflection groups with victims and experts of sacred art and law for more than a year. Rupnik's artwork at the shrine will also no longer be illuminated each evening during the Lord's nightly candlelight rosary processions. It's official. Blessed Carlo Acutis is becoming a saint. He will be the first millennial to be canonized in the Catholic Church. The College of Cardinals approved his canonization this week, a month after Pope Francis approved a second miracle attributed to the Italian teen. A devout Catholic and avid programmer, Acutis documented Eucharistic miracles on a website he designed. He passed away from cancer in 2006 at the age of 15. Courtney Mares, Rome correspondent for Catholic News Agency and author of Blessed Carlo Acutis, A Saint in Sneakers, shares why the future saint has inspired millions around the world.
Carlo was born in 1991, the same year as the launch of the World Wide Web. He loved computer coding and video games, and truly will be the church's first tech-savvy saint. But I think you also can't talk about Carlo Acutis without talking about his devotion and his love of the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And Carlo just had an authenticity about him and a love of God that was simply contagious and continues to be so for so many people.
Pope Francis said the canonization mass of Acutis will be announced at a later date. Many speculate he will be canonized during the church's 2025 Jubilee year. The announcement of his canonization comes just 2 weeks ahead of the National Eucharistic Congress in the United States, of which Acutis is a patron. 10 years before that jubilee, Pope Francis launched a major attempt to untangle the Vatican's Byzantine financial web. In 2015, he appointed the Vatican's first ever auditor general in an effort to stamp out financial mismanagement and corruption. In a report earlier on our sister broadcast, EWTN News Nightly, reporter Colin Flynn introduced us to that auditor, Libero Malone, who told us about his relationship with the Pope, his initial shock at seeing the accounts, meeting resistance from the Vatican's old guard when he attempted an audit, and the pontiff's reaction to his findings of financial misconduct. After 2 years, Malone says a high-ranking cardinal, Angelo bet you, forced him to resign as he uncovered more and more corruption. A Vatican court has since convicted Becciu of embezzlement and abuse of office. Maloney has sued the Vatican on grounds of reputational damage and loss of income. The Vatican dismissed the claims earlier this year, and now Maloney is appealing. Colin brings us more of this interview as Maloney explains what he faced as he tried to audit the accounts.
In March of 2016, so several weeks before my last meeting with the Pope, I had a meeting with Archbishop Becciu of the Secretary of State and Monsignor Perlasca and Mr. Tirabassi to discuss the audit of the financial statements of the Secretary of State, Secretariat of State. And we had a meeting, and they showed me a piece of paper in which they had some 700 million worth of investments split between real estate and financial investments. And I asked for supporting documentation. And they started saying that it was going to be difficult to obtain the supporting documentation. And I thought, well, you know, if I don't have supporting documentation, I can't do my audit work. And they said, well, you know, especially the property we have in England. I said, well, you know, why should the lawyers withhold the information to you? I'm the general auditor for the Vatican. I'm not an external person. You should be able to get the information. Mm. That information was never made available. Now, in 2019, when the Sloane Avenue debacle came up, I said to myself, oh, now I know why, you know, I'd raised the quail in the high grass. Mm. I started asking the wrong questions.
This is where the London property that they had invested in and then thrown good money after bad and lost
several hundred millions.
But surely for you then, major...
Well, that was one example. Yes. The other example was that Cardinal Pell and the Council of the Economy had agreed to name PricewaterhouseCoopers as the auditors for the Vatican.
The external auditors.
The external auditors, which had been decided even before I was chosen. Monsignor Becciu was getting a bit anxious because he called me one day and he said, what do you think about PricewaterhouseCoopers carrying out the external audit? And I said, well, it was a decision taken by the Vatican before I turned up. I have no comments to make. Ah, but, you know, they're prying into our affairs. I said, you know, they're auditors. They're not prying. They're doing their work and they will report to whoever they have to report. And they said, oh, no, we think we have to cancel this contract.
Because everything would have been on the table then.
Yes.
For you and then everyone to see.
Yes.
And in your lawsuit against the Vatican, you were saying that you were dismissed because of three main points. The first, the London property deal. You were starting to uncover documentation that was hinting at this huge scandal, which has since broken. Cardinal Angelo Becciu has been found guilty of embezzlement and fraud. And then the second one was that funds had been used in a questionable way to finance the extension and renovation of the head of the Vatican police. And then the third one was bringing in those external auditors who you say again?
Consultants,
might have uncovered a web of corruption and financial mismanagement at the highest levels of the Roman Curia.
Well, I didn't write that.
This is not your belief that there was corruption and mismanagement at the highest level?
No, I believe that there was corruption, but it wasn't part of my claim.
But because you were onto things, because you were starting to uncover...
Because I'd uncovered a number of things. Some were apparent to me, but I've written lots of reports to the Pope in which I'd identified many strange transactions carried out by cardinals and archbishops. And I've kept these reserved with the Pope, and I'm not going to talk about them in detail.
This quote, cardinals putting money in their own pockets.
Yes.
But that is the same thing, isn't it? Financial mismanagement and corruption at the highest levels. If cardinals are taking money and putting it in their pockets.
Corruption can mean other things as well. What I meant was they, instead of using money they were receiving for the benefit of the cash street they were using, this money ended up in their own pockets. It doesn't mean that they were actually corrupting others.
But they were defrauding the department to which the money was meant
yes.
to go to. Princes of the Church, next in line to become Pope, are lining their own pockets.
Yes, but it happened. And it was part of my report to the Pope, in which I underlined these issues, and the Pope requested that these things be resolved.
When the Pope heard these concerns of yours and he saw the evidence that you were putting in front of him, What was his reaction?
He was overwhelmed. He didn't believe that this could happen. But I had all the detail, and he examined it and understood. And he also asked me to explain to the entities involved where the mistakes were, because they needed to rectify. In fact, the money came back.
So he took the approach that this was maybe just incompetence or a misunderstanding, and then the money would be returned. If you explained to them, showed them the error of their ways.
That's a way of putting it, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. Did you ever confront the cardinals about it and face-to-face?
Oh, where we discussed the issues, I told the cardinals what the mistakes were.
Mm. How did they react?
Maybe they didn't like it, but the money came back into the dicastery.
And are we talking hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands? Huh?
Several hundred thousand euros.
Several hundred thousand euros. The apartment, your office was within Vatican, wasn't it? The office you were working in?
Well, it was outside the walls. It was
outside
across the
walls.
The road.
But a Vatican apartment.
It was extraterritorial, yes. Yeah.
The day your office was raided, and then subsequently you were forced to sign a letter of resignation, but which I guess you didn't want to do, but that you say they threatened you. What did they threaten you with?
Well, first of all, the day started in the morning by meeting Cardinal Becciu, who told me that the Pope had lost faith in the work I was doing. So I said, this is very strange. Can I speak to the Pope? He said, oh, no, you can't speak to the Pope. You have to go and speak to the commander of the Vatican police. And they said that I had to confess. I said, well, confess what? And they pulled out two invoices to show that I was embezzling. And it was with the consultant who I'd called in to check the bugs in my computer. Okay? And there were two invoices for 27,000. One October, one November of 2015. They showed me these two invoices. They were photocopies, first of all. And I looked at them and I said, this is correct and this is wrong. And they said, why can you say that? I said, because that is approved by me and that isn't approved by me. They said, well, no, but it has the stamp of your office. I said, that has a stamp of my office and my signature. That has a stamp of my office and a scroll. So that document is false.
So why did you sign the letter of resignation?
Well, they, as I said, they accused me of these things. They interrogated me the whole afternoon. They took away all the documentation from the office. They also took away the documentation in my colleague's office, Ferruccio, who that day wasn't in the office. I said, there's nothing for me to confess. But they treated me, if you don't confess, you don't know what harm will come to your family. We'll declare you to the fiscal police in Italy. All this sort of stuff.
So they were threatening you with physical violence.
Oh, yes.
And your family.
And, you know, at that point I said, what's the point of staying on here? Yeah. So at 8:30 in the evening, so it was, you know, a long day, I said, I'm going to resign.
Mm. And you didn't hear from the Pope after that?
No, but Cardinal Pell spoke to the Pope, and I got the impression from Cardinal Pell that even the Pope was surprised. Mm. But I've never spoken to him. I've sent seven letters to the Pope, hoping to meet with him, to explain. Yeah, but he's met people in the prisons, he's met all sorts of people in the world, but he hasn't met me.
Any report about Vatican finances is very complex, and this story is no different. To hear more details about Libero Maloney's experience investigating the Vatican money trail, his ouster, and his current lawsuit, you can watch Colm's full interview on EWTN's YouTube page.
We care about kids here.
Which ones? You can't see the ones sitting right outside on your doorstep?
Next, our discussion with actor Demetrius Gross as he shares his thoughts on the impact of his new film, Sound of Hope.
Are you sure these people want us?
We know they do.
You're going to be my little boy now.
Alone, neglected, and even abused, children forgotten in the foster care system find a home in an unlikely place. More than 400,000 children are in the foster care system in the United States. Some are passed from house to house and shelter to shelter. Many end up homeless. A new film aims to highlight this vulnerable population and how churches can play a role in helping them. Sound of Hope, the story of Possum Trot, follows Donna and Reverend W.C. Martin as they inspire their rural Texas church to embrace children in the foster care system that nobody else would take. Overcoming many trials, 22 families ultimately adopted 77 children. Award-winning actor and producer Demetrius Gross portrays Reverend Martin, a Baptist minister, in Sound of Hope. He recently sat down with us in our D.C. studio and shared how he hopes this film will inspire others of faith to help children in the foster care system. Demetrius, thank you so much for joining me, and congratulations on the release of Sound of Hope. It's a powerful film, hard to watch at certain times. What drew you to take on this role?
I think just the story, the legacy of Bishop W.C. Martin and First Lady Donna Martin, it's a true story. They banded together the 22 families that adopted 77 of the hardest to place foster children, foster care, children in the foster care system in East Texas. And, you know, when you get an opportunity to portray such heroes, you if you have a heart, so to speak, you can't turn that kind of opportunity down. I think acting, art, us in our greatest manifestation as actors, as performers, is portraying these kinds of stories that are hope-filled and positive and can provoke change.
And this is a true story as well. What did you know about foster care and the foster care system going into taking on this role, and how does that compare to what you know now? I'm curious about what you learned and what surprised you the most.
Well, I didn't know much. You know, I didn't come from a foster care scenario growing up. So I had to do a deep dive into my research and, you know, realizing that there are over 400,000 children just in the U.S. alone that are still waiting to be adopted. And just looking at the horrible statistics about child trafficking and incarceration rates and how our orphan crisis matriculates into those awful systems. And so to me, this felt like a cause movie. And it felt like a great movie cinematically.
You mentioned how many children are in the foster care system, and they're so often hidden, kind of out of sight, out of mind in our society. This is a powerful movie, but it also feels like a call to action.
Absolutely.
Do you hope and do you think, in your opinion, that more local churches should take on a mission like Bennett Chapel did in Possum Trot, and should reach out and take on foster care children?
I think so. I think the beauty in this story is, while Bennett Chapel is categorically a Pentecostal Baptist church, the call to action in this film is non-denominational. And I think it's important for us to realize that this is not a religious film. It's not a faith-based movie, but it is, in fact, a faith-fueled movie. Faith, belief, unfettered, unconditional love is at the bedrock of this story, and it really takes all of us, regardless of our denomination, regardless of our creed even. This is a film that we feel so proud to bring to the world, because if you have a heart to help, if you have a heart to elevate our communities and better our children's futures, you're going to feel something and be changed when you watch this movie, regardless of whatever denomination you are.
You know, really powerful insights that you just shared. And I understand you were baptized Catholic. You went to a local Catholic high school here in Washington, D.C.
St. Aloysius Gonzaga. Pray for us.
All the time. How did that formation lend itself to your preparation for this role as a Baptist bishop, as a Baptist minister?
Well, at Gonzaga, not too far from our studios here, you know, we have a phrase called being a man for others. That is like the moniker. Anyone who's come through the halls of Gonzaga know that phrase, and that's something that sticks with you. We do community service at the McKenna Center, all through the city, soup kitchens, so others may eat. Mm-hmm. All of these kinds of initiatives are grafted into our, you know, our academic journey there at school. And I think for me, learning about the Martins and mm-hmm. how they just had such a heart for service, regardless of sometimes having limited resources, whether that be financially or even just infrastructure to house these kids. What a great example we had as the actors in this film to follow suit with that, to use that story, their legacy that's still being made to this day as a blueprint and as a paradigm to graft into. We were fortunate in that, to have such a powerful legacy being our North Star that we were aiming at when we were making this film.
And a great example for us all, Demetrius. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
You can see Demetrius Gross in Sound of Hope, the story of Possum Trot, now in theaters nationwide. That does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We'll be back same time next week with a program focusing on the wrap-up of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage as those pilgrims near their final destination, the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Stunning views, touching stories, and answered prayers, all centered around our Eucharistic Lord. We'll see you then.